Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New Books Network, Native American Studies and History. This is Ryan Tripp yet again, here to introduce you to another new book in the field. Today we have Professor Drew Lopenzina from Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. He is the author of a much lauded study on Native American authors and authority and print culture in the colonial and early republic periods, Red Ink. I'm familiar with his earlier book, as is, I think, many people in Native studies and history. He just recently published earlier this year the book that we're going to be discussing, Through the Indian's Looking Glass, a cultural biography of William Apis Pequot. Professor Lopenzina, welcome.
Hi, Ryan. How are you?
So before we start, we get into anything else, I'd like to discuss this lovely cover of your new book. It's a photo montage of an 1831 portrait of William Apis Pequot, who we're going to be discussing in a brief minute, as well as a Methodist camp meeting as depicted by Harry Peters, America on Stone. Can you elucidate and elaborate on this photo montage cover?
Yeah, well, I mean, for the cover, I'd like to say I have complete control over the artistic design of the book. That's not necessarily true, but I chose the images. So with William Apis, there's really only this one image that we have of him, and it's the portrait that was done probably in 1830, I guess, by John Paradise, who was a portraitist who had done a lot of work with the Methodist organization at the time. So I think anybody who's familiar with Apis has seen this picture. It was the frontispiece of the second edition of his memoir, Son of the Forest. So we didn't want to just put the picture on the book, and I really kind of struggled with so how can we do this a little bit different? And the idea I had was to make it look like he was looking at his own image in a looking glass, number one. And then the scene behind it, the Harry Peters painting, I looked at a lot of representations of Methodist camp meetings, and this one just kind of struck me. It's actually kind of problematic. The painting itself that it's drawn from, Harry Peters did a lot of so I probably shouldn't even draw people's attention to this, but he did a lot of really sort of insulting, sort of stereotypical Jim Crow type art in this time period. And you can, if you could see the painting clearly, you'd notice that a little bit. There's a representation of a Negro and a real minstrel sort of tradition. But in the picture, it looked like the preacher was a dark-skinned preacher, and that's what I was looking for, somebody who could be possibly a Native American sitting up on that, because this is a scene that would have been very familiar to Apis. This would have been the real lifeblood of his ministry, was going to these sort of camp meetings, and he always spoke so warmly of them. And it was just the image that I could find to sort of lay in the back that most closely represented that aspect of his experience.
Very interesting. So the reason it's slightly the cover is slightly blurred is that it's representing the looking glass. Just wanted to confirm that.
Yeah, exactly.
Very interesting. So William Apis claimed that his father William Apis's father, is it Apis? It's just Apis with one S. Yes,
that's right. The original spelling, at least the spelling that his father seems to have used and that he used himself through some of his life, is just with the one S. There's a lot of discussion about how to pronounce his name.
Yes, I've read.
So I don't know if you want to go into detail about that. The interesting thing is I saw in his marriage certificate, it was spelled A-P-I-S. And it occurred to me at that moment that he had said his name to the preacher who was writing it up for him, and so that person spelling it phonetically spelled it A-P-I-S, which suggests to me that it was a piss. I could have gone different ways, but I still say Apis, and I know there are others who would go a different route with that.
Yeah, most scholars that I've heard pronounce it Apis. So William Apis claimed that his father was the offspring of a Mashantucket Pequot woman and a white man, quoting him. You further explained that his gradually emancipated mother, Candace Apis, was most likely the offspring of a Pequot matron basket seller. There's speculation that perhaps it was Ann Wampy, and a man of African-American descent. William Apis also recorded that in 1802, 1803, his parents, quote, quarreled, parted, and went off a great distance, leaving their helpless children to the care of their maternal Pequot grandparents. You add that 20 years would pass before Apis saw his mother's face again. What did Pequot mean to William Apis, first as a child and then as an adult, across figurative and, in your book, at times literal, X-marked native space? In addition to that, can you also elaborate on any probable reunion with his mother, that you refer to, prior to her 1838 death in Hartford?
Yeah. So, first of all, a lot of this is based on... I just go by what Apis tells us in his memoir. So he talks about his grandfather, paternal grandfather being a white man. He talks about his paternal grandmother being a native woman of the Pequot Nation. And so this is the information he gives us. I searched, I did a lot of digging to try and figure out who those people might be. And really, I came up short. And it was one of the big disappointments of this research was not being able to identify who those people are. I have some guesses. They're interesting guesses, and I speculate a bit about it in the book. But as for his mother was a slave. She belonged to a Captain Taylor. Again, my understanding, because Apis is not really, I think there are a lot of reasons that he's not anxious to broadcast this information. So he doesn't actually ever say that his mother was in slavery when he was born, but it's clear that she was, and that it's very possible that his father actually sold land to have her emancipated or to arrange the marriage that they ultimately had. And Apis himself, by Connecticut law, would have been a slave had he been born in Connecticut. And this is really interesting because in 1798, when he was born, your condition followed the condition of your mother, and his mother was a slave. And so he would have been in slavery by law, except he was born in Partis. Massachusetts. I'm sorry?
Partis law, yeah? That you're referring to?
Yeah, the gradual emancipation law.
Yes.
Right. And so, and even that law was not in effect quite yet, I think, or maybe it had just come into effect. So at any rate, he's born in Massachusetts, and it's possible that the family went up there to avoid him being born in Connecticut for that reason. As for his Pequot culture, I guess the only thing I can say is the way he was raised. I think even today, like a lot of Native people, can relate to the condition of growing up and not knowing a lot about your heritage. I think particularly in the Northeast, a number of people who I know, amongst my acquaintances who really came to understand their identity a little bit later in life and spent a lot of their life trying to pull it back together and understand it more. And those who made that great commitment and embraced that identity that brought difficulties into their life in some ways, but also a lot of enrichment. I think Apis was like that as well. I think as an indentured servant, he was raised with white families after he left his grandparents' house, and there was nothing. So what's interesting is he didn't have a lot of direct contact with his Pequot culture. And this was part of the design of the settler colonial state, was to break up these family networks, to do everything you could to disenfranchise this culture and break up their attachment to their community and their land base. So he had contacts, and we don't want to say that there was nothing there, but I think it was difficult for him to understand a lot of it and to maintain really firm relationships. And but he never was allowed to forget that he was Indian, right? So the people who raised him, the white family that he was indentured to, the Furmans, He relates how, like, Mr. Furman, whenever he got angry with him, which seems to be pretty frequently, would not only whip him, but would say, like, would call him "you Indian dog," and other denigrations of that sort. And so Apis was very much reminded of his, I guess, subaltern status. But at the same time, he wasn't ever fully a part of his own community. Now, he did have contact with that community, and it's almost an invisible part of his narrative at certain places. And we have to sort of read between the lines to figure out just how much contact he had. I think as a child, he clearly, you know, he would go to visit his father from time to time, and he had other contacts with the spiritual community that he tried to have relationships, but the Furmans were always trying to disrupt that connection. And he says himself that once his family broke up, his mother and father left. This was a common condition for Native children at this time. And it's heartbreaking when you start to realize the enormity of this, how these families were deliberately torn apart and economically, you know, even if you could try to keep the family together, the father would have to go off either working as farmhands, wherever the work was, or a lot of Pequot men worked on whaling ships and would be gone for years at a time. And so the family unit, it was hard to keep it together, and the women were often left in incredibly vulnerable situations themselves, and often were servants of households as well themselves, and so it was hard for them to raise their own children. And so it wasn't unusual that his parents left, but in Apis's case, he writes that when his parents kind of went their own way when he was about 4 years old, he didn't see his mother's face again, he says, for another 20 years. And I would imagine that when he did run into her again, it was, you know, he would have had enough connections within the community to find her. It's interesting. He says that he never mentions meeting his mother again, right? So this is another absence in his narrative. But except for that one thing, he says it would be 20 years before I saw their faces again. So he must have seen her on his travels. He probably, you know, knew where she was, and if she was living in Hartford for all that time, we know she died in the Hartford area. He probably. You know, this was on his route, and so he would probably stop in maybe more than once as an adult when he reconnected with her, but we just don't know.
Thank you. That clarified that for me. I'm going to read a quote from William Apis. William Apis laments that I could never think that the government acted right toward the natives, not merely refusing to pay us, but in claiming our services in cases of perilous emergency, in his case, the War of 1812, and still deny the right of citizenship. And as long as our nation is debarred the privilege of voting for civil officers, I shall believe that the government has no claim on our services. How does, as you contend, his declaration of nationhood and the inclusive pronoun "our" reflect his emerging notions of native sovereignty?
Okay, it's important to understand that. So William Apis fought in the War of 1812, and he was not of service age when he was conscripted into the army. He was 15 years old, and ostensibly they brought him in as a drummer boy. That was sort of a way they could get around this, but he was immediately marshaled into service once they got their hooks on him in the army, and they marched him up to Plattsburgh, where he was ultimately stationed. And so he's a 15-year-old child. He talks about, you know, it must have been a difficult thing for a native child marshaled into the U.S. Army, having to fight for a country and a nationality to which he had very little allegiance. Really, in most ways, I think, right? I mean, he knew that, and he writes about this in an ironic tone, that these were my conquerors, and I was forced to go up and fight for them, and they would. He was teased relentlessly. Some of the officers would joke about tying him to the stake and torturing him, and so that was the kind of stuff he put up with. But so he's a young man when he's a 15, 16-year-old man when he's noticing a lot of these things at the end of the war, and realizing this dynamic. Of course, he's writing about it in 1829. So this is many years later when his political consciousness, by the time he's writing his memoir, he has a whole different consciousness about all of this than perhaps he had when he was a 15, 16-year-old adolescent fighting those battles. But nevertheless, I believe in the war, He made a lot of attachments with Native people. The army was working closely with local Mohawk communities in the area, and it looks like he was stationed Eliezer Williams, who is a interesting but controversial figure from the Mohawk community. But they would have been fighting together in the same fort in one of the decisive battles of the war, which was the Battle of Plattsburgh. At any rate, I believe when Apis left the war, he left with these Mohawk communities and he ended up living in Canada, probably as a deserter. Why else would you go to Canada at that point after the War of 1812? And he was staying with these Haudenosaunee Mohawk communities, probably the Tiendanega Mohawk for the most part. And he was impressed by some of the cohesion that was in this community that may have been lacking amongst the Pequot community, who had sort of been at ground zero of colonialism from the start, and had suffered more disruption the Pequots had. But he's noticing these dynamics. He certainly heard the grievances of soldiers at the time. And by the time he's writing this, by 1829, he's really developed a much more political consciousness. And he understands that natives were poorly treated, that they weren't given that the promises that were made, most of them were not paid after their services. Their reward was basically that the lands that they had fought and aligned with the U.S. Army to protect were now being offered to white soldiers as compensation, because the army couldn't afford to pay people in money in currency, and so often land was offered instead, and that was always, of course, indigenous land that was being offered. So I think, I guess, to answer your question, by the time William Apis is writing this, he has very much developed the consciousness of Native people as part of his identity. He's embraced this at this point in his life, but it's something that's just beginning to form when he is the young man who's actually experiencing this, if that makes sense, right?
Yes, it does. In his 1836 eulogy to King Philip, William Apis calls for all, quote, red children to pray to the Great Spirit, the Indian God. Now, you argue that in this passage, Apis transports himself back to his 1815-1816 ascent to the summit on the Bay of Quinte before the soundless Lake on the Mountain mystery, whose waters, sprung from underground currents, continue to feed the fluid materials of a spiritual narrative that cascade downward from that pure source through hollowed rock and into the earth's moving waters. Of this place, where the people of the forest held all things in common, Apis cannot speak. Why was this ascent to the Lake on the Mountain so significant for William Apis? Did the summit represent an awakening for what you describe as his negative work?
Yeah, so it's important to understand that this is a moment in Apis's 1829 memoir, A Son of the Forest, that where he talks about, he sort of just throws it in randomly, almost as though he just happened to be a tourist traveling around Canada, and he experienced what he calls this mysterious body of water that according to local legend, is soundless, he says, which means it has no bottom, right? You could just keep going down and down and down. And he just talks about it as this natural wonder of sorts. And he also talks about a rock with a hole in it. And so he kind of throws it in there in this one paragraph. And in the 1829 edition, as he mentions this, he describes, and then I turn, you know, as though he's standing before these sites. And then he says, I turned around and I saw the children of the forest and the order and regularity of their encampments. And in the 1829 edition, he adds, and they held all things in common, which he extracted from the 1831 version, which is the one that most people read. But so there's been a lot of speculation about this passage. Lisa Brooks, who's an Abenaki scholar, who wrote a book called The Common Pot that is highly regarded in indigenous Native studies circles. And she talks about this as, and other scholars have looked at this moment too. It's one of those moments where you realize that William Apis can't really, in the 18, late 1820s and 1830s, when William Apus is writing, as a Methodist missionary, by the way, as a Methodist preacher, he cannot speak to indigenous spirituality, not in this sort of discursive setting. It's just not something that he can talk about or embrace in any way, because it's forbidden speech in some ways. He's speaking as a Christian, and his whole authority comes from this Christian identity that he performs and has embraced, but he performs it on the stage, and that's where he gets his ability to critique Western culture from, and the authority to be a scold and a powerful speaker advocating for native rights. So he gets all that authority from this Christian subject position that he's embraced, but at the same time, he's very aware of how native communities are still practicing their own spiritual, perhaps syncretic systems of worship and belief and ceremony, that these things survive. And so Lisa Brooks refers to this moment up on that lake as his native conversion experience, that despite his profession of Christianity, this is where he actually is opened up to an indigenous spirituality and an understanding of indigenous community and in indigenous space. So people have speculated something interesting is going on there. Nobody was able to pinpoint where this place was until I went up there and discovered that he's talking about what's called the Lake on the Mountain in the Bay of Quinte. And it's in Ontario, and it's this really rather spectacular and perhaps powerful spot. But I believe that when Apus was there, it wasn't by chance that he was there. He didn't just stumble upon this place. So I want to remind you that William Apus is, and I talk about this a lot in my book, I think it's really important. You have to understand William Apus is a child of trauma. He's suffering from the cultural trauma of just being Pequod in the 1830s, which is enough in and of itself if you understand the history leading into that, and being abandoned as a child, being severely beaten by his grandmother, which is an incident that I talk about in great length in the opening passages of the book, something that he also bravely talks about, I think. But that's a real trauma. I mean, severely beaten, broken bones. And then he's indentured out to white families, separated from his community, and he's whipped and treated badly. And his indenture is traded as though he were a slave at times. And then as a 15-year-old child, he's brought into war. He's fought in some of the fiercest combat of the War of 1812. So when I say he's a child of trauma, I mean that very literally. He is somebody who's suffered severe traumas in his life. And so in this period when he's in Canada after the war, he's really just trying to figure out how to stay on his feet. And I think he finds solace in these indigenous communities, particularly the Tyendinega Mohawk, who he's staying with. And he's not at this place by chance, as he suggests in the book, that he just kind of dropped in. He's there for ceremony. And this is speculation on my part. I know he was there for ceremony. This is a very powerful place in the spiritual community of the local indigenous people. But he's there, I think, for a healing ceremony, for many of the warriors who had been in the battle and been in war to heal themselves and to reintegrate them back into the community. And so this is a really important place to him. And to get back to your question, this is a long, winding road, but by 1836, many, many years later, when he's performing his spectacular eulogy on King Philip, and he's speaking in the voice of the Wampanoag leader from the 17th century, King Philip, the famous Wampanoag leader, and he invokes, at some moment, he starts speaking of the Indian god, and at that moment, he's sort of speaking in the voice of Philip, and almost unmooring himself from his otherwise Christian subject position. And I think, so what I'm doing at that moment in the book, which sounds perhaps like romantic language, but I'm sort of seeing how at that moment Apus is drawing on this the sustenance of these moments that sort of he glues together to create his own indigenous identity. And part of that is that native conversion experience, as Lisa Brooks described it, on the lake on the mountain, and also certain aspects of Pequot tradition and Pequot culture, where these certain places where there are brooks and water moving through rock, just as in Tiandanega, are really places of power. And so I think Apis is drawing on that indigenous side of his identity here, that indigenous power to perform this history on stage. And that's what I'm trying to invoke and bring all of these elements together at this moment, which is at the highlight of his career, I think, as a public speaker and advocate for Native causes.
Yes, we'll discuss trauma in more detail in a minute. It's a prominent lens throughout your book. You contend that the Apis family, William Apis's family, quite possibly was providing refuge for a female slave listed in the 1830 census for their Manhattan households. Can you elaborate a little bit on this? This possibility? I only ask because the same census taker described his wife, Mary, who was the child of an English woman and apparently a native, ambiguous native of Spain. The census taker described her as a colored female, one precarious step above a chattel slave. So can you elaborate more on that?
Yeah. First of all, I take that from the 1830 census. So Apis was living in New York in 1830. And I only know this actually from the 1830 census. It's one of the rare moments where Apis appears in the archive in a way that he didn't insert himself there. In other words, you know, his books and his writings, of course, put him in the archive. But here's where the white dominant power culture sort of noticed him. They wrote his name down, that he was living, I want to say, on King Street in Manhattan at that time. And so if you know how these censuses are set up, it lists all the members of the household. And so it says that he's there. And then it says there's two children there. And I'm sure it was two of Apis's younger children at the time. And then it says one colored woman, but then it lists one person as in the status as slave. And this was a special category and designation in the census sheets. And so it's really, I mean, that's it. That's all I had to go on there. And I know Apis spoke out against slavery enough. I know he wouldn't have had his own, he would, of course, not have been a slave owner himself, particularly given his own personal history and his politics and everything else. But so my speculation, so what was that person doing there? I don't know. Was he harboring a runaway slave? New York was going through its own gradual abolition law at the time. It's a bit of a mystery. It's just something that it popped out in the census records to me. And I felt as somebody who's telling this story, I had to make sense of it somehow, or at least try. Apis was very much involved with the abolitionist movements at this time. And he was in those circles. So I speculate that perhaps he was harboring an escaped slave. This, of course, is not something that he would tell to the census taker. I don't know how the census takers could write things down just based on what their own assessment was. And sometimes, you know, if they saw a person of color, they might just mark that person as a slave. Why they distinguished his wife. And again, I don't even know if that was his wife. The other woman of color there was not, I don't believe, designated as his wife. But I speculate that it must have been. It could have been his sister. You know, so there are other possibilities, but because there were also two children there, I can only guess.
Yes, a compelling passage in the book. You also argue that in William Apis's 1834 memorial, which was drafted shortly after his family's adoption into the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and then published in the Anti-Slavery Liberator, that this memorial has not been reprinted anywhere since.
That's right.
I include it as a seminal contribution to Native literature. Now, in the context of Apis's role in the Mashpee Nullification Revolts, why was this memorial a seminal contribution to late Native literature?
Well, first of all, any document written by a Native at this time, at a time when so few Native people had the education and or even the means to appear in print. It's an important document just on the basis of that alone. But it's also just a really fascinating document because of its historical position within what was known as, you know, the Mashpee Revolt, which is a misnomer, of course. But
yes.
So it's an important document in terms of that history. But it's a document. So it was hidden. He talks about writing this thing, and I picked up in a number of different places by people in the press. Often enemies of APHIS in the press, who there were particular newspapers in Barnstable that were very harshly critical of APHIS and wanted to see him locked up. But I gathered somehow that he had written and printed this document, and nobody knew about it. And so I had it was really kind of some painstaking work to finally locate it in the working through the digital archives. But I finally found that it was published in the Liberator, and that he had written it in jail. And so it kind of puts it in this interesting tradition. Not only is this important historical document, it's an unknown document by William Apis that is it's not a huge document, but it's about, you know, 5 or 6 pages long or thereabouts. And so it's a significant document, and it's also really, it contributes, it's within this tradition of what I call, like, you know, the indigenous prison literature, where he's writing this from jail. He's in jail because of his peaceful resistance. He had committed, I mean, it's absurd, really. He was arrested for trespassing and inciting a riot. He was trespassing on his own ground at the Mashpee Meeting House, which was built and erected for the Mashpee to use. And the riot that was incited were the white people that were trying to actually lynch him because they were upset that he was kind of wrecking this great system, this thing they had, that they could just come into Mashpee land and take their wood for free and use those resources to enrich themselves, with the Mashpee receiving nothing in return. So William Apis, the whole Indian nullification movement, was meant to break up this racket of white domination. And so this document speaks to all of those things, but it's written in jail. And so, to me, one of the fascinating things about the whole thing that happened in Mashpee in 1833 and 1834 is that it's one of the first moments, if not the first moment, that we can identify of somebody putting tactics of civil disobedience into effective practice, even before Thoreau is ever talking about it. And like Thoreau, like Martin Luther King, like other people who sort of stand at the forefront of movements of civil disobedience, Apis went to jail for it. And this document comes right out of prison. And so, to me, it's almost like Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail, in a way, where Apis's, his position in jail is conferring a kind of moral authority on him. He's witnessing for his community by spending time in jail. And while he's spending time in jail, he's in jail to expose the injustices that have been rampant in this community. And he's also forging this document that is ultimately going to lead to the restoration of Mashpee rights. So I think it's a really important document, and it was a really exciting find.
Yeah, it was an exciting moment in the book. Going toward his end of his life and the end of the book, you suggest that William Apis's penultimate and enigmatic theatrical role as Indian prophet, and again, like the revolt, I'm quoting this, Indian prophet, in turn served as a generative narrative framework because there was no one who came forward to bind Apis's wounds. How did this 1837 role help Apis overcome the, quote, traumatic moment, defined by both you and trauma specialist Jonathan Shea, speaking of trauma, as thermos, or an unexpected catastrophe that shatters the social narrative framework by which one has ordered one's life? Did this traumatic moment for Apis derive from his own life as well as his identity as a Pequot, which we earlier discussed?
Okay. Yeah, so I have to unpack that a little bit. This is this interesting moment, and I was discovering this simultaneously with a couple of other scholars out there. Philip Gora talks about it in his book briefly. Daniel Radis is another person who's been doing Native studies who came upon this. But what it was, and what's enabled this is to be quite honest, is digital archives, where you can go into newspaper, do these newspaper database searches, and all of a sudden Apis started showing up in interesting places where nobody knew he had been. And so part of it, and I was able to do some additional archiving on this that helps to round out the story somewhat. It's still a bit mysterious though. So at the end of his career, Apis moves away from the role of Methodist preacher, it seems like. And by the time he gets to the eulogy on King Philip, so it's important to understand that Apis, his moment of fame, and for about 10 years, he was almost a household name. I mean, Apis was a known figure in the Northeast in the late 1820s and through the 1830s. And he could go, he had these circuits that he'd go around. He was a great self-promoter, and he was great at promoting his books and his causes. But he would go to these various churches and meeting houses and whatnot, and he would attract really big crowds, and they'd come to see the Indian preach. And just as was the case with Sansom Ockham, a generation earlier, the great Mohegan preacher, people came to see the spectacle, I think, as much as, you know, this was a novelty. The Indian, who's supposed to be the unschooled savage, of course, standing up in front of the pulpit and delivering the word of God, such as it is. And so this was an act worth seeing. And so people would come to see it, and he had a thing going, but he had little bit of a falling out with the Methodist organization, and he started his own ministry in Mashpee for a while, where he started the Church of the Free and United Church of Mashpee, I believe it was called. And he could have stayed there. And scholars have tried to speculate what happened in Mashpee, why he didn't leave. And there was some speculation that he had a falling out with the people at Mashpee. I don't think that was true necessarily. And he bought a house there. I found where the house was, and there's some interesting backstory to that didn't make it into the book. But so at any rate, the point being, he might have stayed there, but for some reason he didn't. He could have had a pretty nice gig in Mashpee, but he decided to move on, and part of that was probably just because he still had a calling, and he had been very effective in these sort of long-range itinerant routes that he operated. Whatever the case, and so part of it is, I believe it was his trauma that pushed him forward, that he couldn't stay still. And so this is just my interpretation, but I think understanding what I know of trauma and how it can operate on people, I think he was incredibly restless, and moving forward and continuing to stay on the road was a way to sort of outrun it a little bit. And at any rate, he's already started to move away from the ministry when he does his eulogy on King Philip. He moves from the church to the theater. So when he did the eulogy on King Philip, this was at the Odeon Theater. And again, he filled the Odeon Theater in Boston two nights in a row. So we're talking about hundreds of people coming in to see this performance. And then some of the new information that's been uncovered is he continued to take the show on the road once again. And so he's performing at meeting houses and town halls and all these sort of places, delivering this eulogy. And then, so we sort of knew that he'd written the eulogy and this was a departure for him, but now he's in New York City and he's appearing at lecture halls. Clinton Hall was sort of this intellectual salon, if you will, for people interested in cultural talks and whatnot. And it, I think it had been established by the New York University. And he's appearing at Clinton Hall and a number of other places. And we only know this from newspaper advertisements. We don't know the material that he was we don't know the material of the speech that he was delivering. But it was probably, like all his other campaigns in the past, it was probably in promotion of a book that he was working on, or an idea for a book that he had. And in these speeches, he was promoting himself. We can see this from the newspaper advertisements as the Mohawk prophet. And I'm not going to try and say the name. It's got many syllables, and I don't have it in front of me right now. But basically, the provenance of that name, he didn't just make it up. It's actually Handsome Lakes. It was Handsome Lakes' indigenous name. And Handsome Lake was actually... he was an important figure in the Haudenosaunee revitalization movement in the late 1700s. And so I don't think Apis knew a whole lot about Handsome Lake. I don't even think, but I think it was that his interpretation of the name, which he got from Drake's Book of the Indians, which had been published a couple of years earlier, was, I think, Deep Beautiful Lake or something like that. And I think that name for him is once again a touchstone to his Indian conversion experience, that moment in the lake on the mountain, which is a place of power for him, I believe. So here's the thing. I don't think that this helped him recover his trauma. I see this as almost a part of his ongoing trauma. I see it as William Apis all of a sudden wearing this new identity and performing in this different way and appropriating different cultural costumes, if you will, metaphorical costumes, because he's still trying to figure something out. He's still working to understand who he is and where he fits. He's still in some ways a cultural orphan, and this is still part of his trauma acting out in some ways, but at the same time, it's part of his working through it. So Jonathan Shays is somebody who's done a lot of work with veterans, who experience combat trauma, which I believe Apis is one, but I think a lot of scholars have talked about trauma in this way in our contemporary moment, that trauma that we all live within certain cultural narratives, and it's those narratives that give us our identity. These narratives, like in literary theory, we might call it discourse, maybe, but we live in certain discursive regimes, and we get our sense of identity from these regimes or discourses. And trauma is when that narrative gets broken up unexpectedly, violently, explosively, and all of a sudden all the things that help to constitute our identity they no longer hold. You can't maintain those truths anymore because they become inoperative because of the kind of violence that disrupted them. So without going too far deep into all of that, I believe Apis has experienced this kind of deep trauma, and he's still trying to work through it. And part of it is putting on these identities, but part of these identities is also that he's trying to find a new way to reach audiences and a new way to tell Native history. And by telling that history, isn't he engaged in constructing a new narrative, a narrative that settler colonialism has worked so hard to disrupt, to keep the Indian, the Native history and Native experiences out of the picture. And here's William Apis trying to figure out how to tell that history. The eulogy on King Philip is a deeply historical work that tries to see experience from a Native perspective. And I think he's still doing that. So he's trying to create the narrative that can bring us back to what Jonathan Shays calls themis, or the idea of what's right. And what's right has never been, there's never been a voice for what's right for Native people in the dominant discourse. He's trying to create it. And I, you know, I don't know if this is something he can do or not. This is the point where we leave him.
So both perpetuating and overcoming the trauma. Last question. You argue that his wounds, quoting that, And peripatetic, as well as polyamorous, native practices resulted in Apis's separation from his family at the end of his life, his embrace of a new consort, Elizabeth, and periodic intemperance, quoting that, at the end of his life. Yet, in 1837,
let me correct that. I don't say that he had periodic intemperance, nor do I suggest he was polyamorous, or maybe I don't. I'm not suggesting he had multiple partners, but we know that when he died, he was living with a woman named Elizabeth who identified herself as his wife. So it seems that he had moved on to another domestic relationship of some sort that we didn't know about prior to the coroner's report about his death. So what happens in the coroner's report is it suggests that he had been drinking, and this led to a great deal of speculation in the press afterwards, reporting on his death, that Apis had, and I have to say, because this is part of what I explore in my book, is the way that this one little comment that his wife made, that he had been out, he had had a drink or two or something like that, how this got blown up to fill out a cultural stereotype that Apis had descended into sloth and alcoholism and resorted back to his native state, right? Which is what everybody in the dominant culture believes an Indian is somebody who Apis has risen above his status and now he's sinking back down to the place where he belonged. And I think the narrative that is being constructed around him really tries to place him in that position. And what I try to do is kind of unpack that and show that, I mean, I don't know if Apis had an occasional drink. Again, you can see this happens with Samson Ockham. Samson Ockham had to apologize publicly and was humiliated very publicly. He had to make these statements to the religious community that he had been intemperate and whatnot. And later on in his journal, he notes, you know, I was never intemperate. Yeah, I've had a cordial every now and then. But the dominant culture is so eager to fit native people into the little peg hole that they've carved out for them that any little bit of evidence like this can just be exploited to create this whole narrative that I don't think Apis fit into. So what I was trying to point out at the end was that, all right, as an indigenous man, he probably did not know many stable, monogamous relationships in his life. You know, his parents split up. Families were ripped apart routinely in indigenous communities throughout the Northeast. It was a very hard economically and culturally to hold these things together. But it's also maybe important to realize that monogamy is also a Christian import, right? This is not an indigenous tradition. And so there wasn't this deep-rooted tradition of monogamy in Pequod culture. So the fact that he was with another woman at this time in his life, it can almost seem scandalous, perhaps, from a dominant perspective. But from his perspective, it was probably it's not really that unusual. And so there it is. And what I think we need to do is just understand it not as like part of this narrative of descent at the end of his life. I want to see it that William Apis was still really much. Still very much in the game, still trying to follow his vision and his ministry and his mission of advocacy for Native people. And, you know, I talk about at the end of the book about how there's this curious moment I find where he's in Washington, D.C. with a group of, I think, Potawatomi Natives who are visiting D.C. at the time. And he's in contact with them and he like apparently he must have done some sort of impromptu sermon and he brings them out onto the Washington Mall and whatever happened there, we don't know precisely what, but the newspapers saw this as Apis doing a little bit of rabble rousing and he probably was, but it shows Apis still out there stirring up trouble, finding ways to publicize and make visible Native presence in on the U.S. scene. So it's an interesting you know, the end of a story, like a lot of a story, is kind of murky. We're seeing it through that glass darkly to a certain extent. But I want to go against type in my book and read Apis as somebody who's still going at it. And it's often been speculated that his death was because of alcoholism, liver failure, any number of things related to his decline. But when I ran his story past a number of physicians and didn't tell them anything, I just said, here are the symptoms as they are actually presented in the coroner's report. And every single one of them told me that this is a casebook study of appendicitis. A casebook. They said, yeah, that's classic appendicitis. And what happened was he was sick. He was really ill. That was the infection. Probably the infection was moving through his body. And then he felt better just before he died. He gets up, he looks at himself in the mirror. And I thought this was a really compelling moment in some ways to highlight. And then he brushes his teeth, which is this incredibly domestic thing to do. And he sits down for toast and he says, yeah, I feel fine. And then 2 hours later, he's dead. What happened was his appendix ruptured at that point. And often when somebody's appendix rupture, they've had all this pain and pressure and buildup, and all of a sudden it feels okay. You get this incredible relief, but actually at that moment, the infection spreads to the rest of your body and you die. So that's how I'm sort of looking at Apis's last moments, as something that could not have been prevented, could not have been diagnosed. He dies of a ruptured appendix.
So some U.S. and native sources regarded as intemperates, and then you argue instead of polyamorous, native polygamy. I actually have a question about that very compelling, his role as escort and orator for those dignitaries in Washington. Do you have any idea on how he secured this position at all? Any kind of elaborate?
Yeah. I don't think he was in any sort of official capacity at all. I think he was there. He was probably there because I've found that he had churches that he would visit as part of his route. He didn't make it down there often, but he'd been down to Washington before. And I think he was going back down that way, probably to feel out some of his old connections. But I think he just somehow, he found out that there was this contingent of native, ambassadors who were visiting DC, and he went to visit them, and he apparently he created a scene of some sort in probably what I like to think is a positive way. I think this group of natives who had been brought to DC, they were often very they were managed pretty closely. And they weren't supposed to necessarily be off doing their own thing. This was a very tightly orchestrated publicity, bit of public diplomacy on the part of the U.S. and importantly for the native contingency themselves. But I think Apis kind of showed up and he brought them out on the mall and probably gave some sort of lecture or something. Maybe, you know, anything that he had in his wheelhouse of sermons or lectures that he would give. And stirred things up a little bit, and I love that about him. That's what he does. He stirs things up. He's not happy with the status quo, and he's bringing attention to things in ways that completely disrupts the micromanaging of the dominant discourse.
Agreed on that point. Well, thank you very much, Professor. I also have one final question. Is there anything we can expect for you in the future? Any books you're writing? Any new fresh research that you can discuss at this time?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking. I was asked to write an introduction to Native literature for people who want to teach it and need some assistance. I'm working on that right now. And I guess what I'm envisioning, my next real research project will be looking at the banished colonist Roger Williams from Puritan times, Puritan New England, who founded Rhode Island. But I want to look at his time living with the Narragansett natives, out of that experience, which came this really interesting book that he published called A Key into the Language of America. Williams knew the language, understood it, was pretty intimate with it. But this is a really interesting document, and it gives us a window. Well, I think Williams's life in general will give us a window, but I want to try and see it from a Narragansett perspective and use his book to help unlock that that history a little bit. So that's what I'm envisioning right now.
Definitely looking forward to it. Thank you so much for your time today, Professor.
Thank you, Ryan. I appreciate it.
Yes. For all our listeners, thank you as well. And tune in next time.